It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. General Frank McKenzie, the commander of U.S. Command, Central Command, Monday from the Pentagon announced the last C-17 lifted off from Hamid Karzai International Airport, August 31st, 3:29 p.m. Eastern Time. The last flight out of Afghanistan, the end of our presence there, and the end of a 20-year-long war. Thank goodness. And for all of the bickering, all of the whining, all of the complaining, all of the finger-pointing, all of the blaming, especially pointed at Joe Biden, there is enough to go around. But right now, we won. We accomplished our mission. Bin Laden is gone. It's now time to move forward and move on. Bring our people home, start taking care of them, and move forward in that way. Now, what's sad to me is there are so many people out there who are trying to take this moment and point it all at Joe Biden. It's all Joe Biden's fault. Joe Biden's the one who did all of this. When he was handed a big you-know-what sandwich from multiple administrations, there was never any good going to come out of this for us long term. We could be there another 20 years, and this was going to be the same. Were there some mistakes on the ground at this moment? Yeah, there may have been. There may have been a decision that was made wrong. There certainly was a lot of intelligence that was wrong, especially that someone thought the Afghani army was actually going to be able to hold its own. But we are out. And it's about time. Now, that doesn't mean war is over. The war at home is only just begun. And until we get to the bottom of what happened on January 6th, the same forces are going to be out there pushing the same kind of divisive rhetoric, funding the same kind of white supremacy groups, the same kind of anti-government groups, the same kind of Republican Party groups who are organizing and pushing people to the school board meetings that we've been seeing all across the country. What we're heading for and what the right wing wants, what the fascist class wants, is a January 6th every single day. They want a January 6th every day in every school across this country that they don't agree with. They want chaos. They want anarchy. They want chaos for chaos' sake. And understand, these people are never, let me repeat, never going to be happy. You can never appease them enough. What's frightening on really just a scary level is the kind of rhetoric we're hearing from people that you would consider normally average everyday, you know, just people in your neighborhood who have been radicalized, who have spent all of their time glued to whatever grievance media outlet they're hooked on, believing that their lives didn't turn out the way they wanted, and it's because of fill in the blank, whatever the rage machine wants them to be angry at, and it's now it's school board members, that's where they are. And look, the people who are thrilled with this are the wealthy in this country, the rich people who keep the poor and working class pitted against each other, at each other's throats, so that we don't notice that they've been robbing us blind for decades, that they've been shortchanging us on wages and benefits and destroying our working conditions and our schools and our manufacturing base and our supply chains and all of this stuff. They're masters, absolute masters at keeping us in this constant stage of outrage. You go back to the book 1984 with the daily 2 minutes hate. It's no longer 2 minutes hate. It's 24/7 cable news. It's 24/7 Fox and OAN and this and that and crazy right-wing balloons. It's all kinds of crazy media, all tailored for one thing, to feed the anger, to keep people riled, to keep people ticked off, ready to go and kill their neighbors. And look, this isn't new. This is stuff that's been going on pretty much since the beginning of time. It's just now that they've mastered it. You go back to 2010 when the Tea Party spawn came out of the woodwork. This is the demon spawn of the Tea Party right now that we're seeing. And it's all funded by these rich, these wealthy donors, all funded by these secret groups, these shadow groups who fund these things to the hilt just to keep us pitted against one another. If you've been watching these school board meetings, and I have for the last couple of days, the woman in Escondidas, California, wearing a mama t-shirt, talking about her cubs, and how we're done asking for permission, the pandemic is over, this is our declaration of freedom. And then, we know who you are, and we're gonna do this and that. The guy in... The guy in California who, Santa Monica, who's saying that over a mask, he's ready to start a civil war. He knows, he's got a sign with all of the board members' names, addresses written on it. We know where you live. We're coming for you. It's going to be a civil war. You got this candidate in Northampton County, Pennsylvania, who said, forget going to these school boards with freaking data. We go into these school boards to remove them. I'm going in with 20 strong men, and I'm going to give them an option. You can leave or they can be removed. He's literally talking about physically removing elected board members and installing whomever he wants, much like they wanted to do on January 6th. He said that he was willing to die on this hill. Masks are now the hill we're willing to die for? Masks are now the hill that we're willing to start a civil war over? Masks are now the hill that society is completely, completely breaking down? Forget 20 years of war in Afghanistan, dead soldiers, trillions of dollars in wasted revenue. Forget... That's not a problem, but a cloth that you're required to wear over your face in a classroom, that is a bridge too far, willing to go get the guns. Now understand, this is what they've always wanted. This is what the fetish crowd has always wanted. These are the people who view themselves as uber patriots. These are the Tea Party people. These are the freedom folks. They're going to talk about freedom and liberty without actually understanding what that means. But understand, this is not just a couple of yahoos. Because you go, that's just some loudmouth from eastern Pennsylvania. Or that's just some loudmouth on the West Coast. That's just some loudmouth in Tennessee. It's just some crazy person. No. This is well-funded, well-coordinated, well-orchestrated, and directed by right-wing hate radio. Anger, grievance radio fuels this rage with misinformation and the hateful rhetoric that comes out every day. They want to ruin your children's education. They want to control you. They want to take your liberty. They're coming for you. They're going to make you do X, Y, and Z. They're going to force you to get the shot. And it's got a chip in it. And it's going to make them follow you. And all of this crazy conspiracy stuff. And they're eating it up. And now look, this didn't just happen. This has been 40 years in the making. This is a generation. A generation who was reared on anger and hate and grievance radio. This is the right-wing talk radio success story. This This is exactly what the Powell memo is about. Get people, keep them there, keep feeding them your rhetoric, and you can save the free enterprise system for the wealthy. Now, what's interesting is, you know, I'm struggling with where we are with the vaccine, where we are with the pandemic, because every time I see one of these right-wing mouthpieces who, you know, has been an anti-masker, anti-vax person, you know, saying, oh, it's all a big hoax, and I see them die from COVID, my first thought is, good, bye. You're no longer going to be spreading a message that's going to kill people. And I've said it a bunch of times on this show. It's bad for my karma. It's bad for my soul. And I want to understand what it is that makes someone go, you know, I have the ability to protect myself. I have the ability to protect my family and my children and my friends, but I'm just not going to do it. I struggle with it. Until I read this article by this Dr. Baruch. And it's an interesting perspective that he put forward. But there was one line in there that really grabbed my attention, and I'll get to that in a minute. But he was talking about, you know, from his experience as an ER doctor, where he sees these people every day. The folks who, you know, they were the diehards until that tube comes out, until it's the end. And they know it's the end. He knows it's the end. They know it's the end. Then they beg for the vaccine. Then they beg for any help whatsoever. And he says, look, you know, as a doctor, we go through this all the time. We, you know, we see people who, you know, they caught themselves on fire, you know, lighting up a cigarette while on oxygen. And the first thing that they do when they get out of surgery is reach for a cigarette. We see people do dumb things. We see people who do what's not in their best interest. He said himself, look, I got high blood pressure and I'm elbow deep in a bag of chips. I know it's not the right thing. I do it anyway. And as I thought about what he was saying, I'm going, you know, that's true. I get that argument. So how do we reach people if shame isn't it? Because that's the easy route. Ridicule and shame is the easy route. How do we reach people to help protect themselves? And there was a line in there that grabbed my attention. He says, quote, the anger I feel towards vaccine hesitant people becomes a more complicated emotion when I witness them reckoning with their choices. Many of the unvaccinated people I've talked to are hardworking, loving individuals struggling to catch a break in a life that hasn't been fair. They're unmoored and don't know what to believe when the truth itself has supply chain problems and the healthcare system has been letting them down for years. Now, I've been saying this for the longest time. The economy's let working people down. Our healthcare system's been letting working people down. Our pension systems have been doing it. Our social safety net has been you know, not there to help when it's needed, and people are struggling. And I get that struggle. I get that anger. But I don't understand how you then go, the one thing that I can do to not end up dead is very simple. It's simply a shot, simply a vaccine. And it comes back down to the misinformation that they consume every day. It comes back to the billionaire class who funds these ultra right groups who are, look, their goal is only to cause trouble, only to cause anarchy, only to cause chaos. Chaos for chaos' sake. So that we don't notice that over the course of the pandemic, our 700 billionaires increased their wealth by $1.8 trillion, or 62%. We don't notice that more for them, less for everyone else. We don't notice that wages haven't kept up with inflation for decades. We don't notice that our standard of living is worse and worse and worse. We just know we're angry. And they feed that. They feed that incredibly well. 3 hours hate, all day long. And there was nobody better than it than Rush Limbaugh. There was nobody better than it, from what I understand, than Phil Valentine. There was nobody better at it than the guy from Florida who almost his last breath was the whole thing's a hoax. At what point do we stop? Now this guy's argument was pretty simple. The more we communicate with each other, the more we talk, the more we try to understand, the better we can get. We need to hear people's stories. And I agree with that. I agree with we do need more people to tell their stories, especially those people who are on their deathbed, who, when truth really comes knocking, they find the answer. You know, the weird thing is you listen to these people who say, well, I don't know what's in the vaccine, yet they're going to go to a Tractor Supply and buy a drug made for horses and for cow and for sheep as a deworming drug, and that's going to be their savior? They're going to dope up on zinc and hydroxychloroquine that's made for malaria and to treat lupus? Is that? But don't ask what's in those drugs. It's really a twisted time we live in. Because he's right. The supply chain of information has been so badly screwed up. And the disinformation machine is what is dominating. Because it's always easier to be against something. It's always easier to tear into something. It's always easier to attack someone than it is to actually have a solution. My grandfather always used to say, any idiot can tear down a house with a hammer. It takes a craftsman to build one. So the question is are we willing to tear our democracy down because some child has a hammer? Or is it possible that we can build up our institutions to help get us through this time? We will see. Sadly, I see a January 6th coming very soon. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
On the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1907. That was the day labor leader Luisa Moreno was born in Guatemala City. As a young woman, she fought for the admission of women into Guatemalan universities. After attending journalism school in Mexico City, Luisa moved to New York with her husband and worked as a seamstress. Outraged by low pay, racial discrimination, and poor working conditions, she led organizing efforts on the job. During the Great Depression, she worked as a full-time union organizer, first with the AFL, organizing Black and Latina cigar rollers in Florida. But she also became active with the Communist Party and joined CIO efforts to organize cannery workers. Luisa led unionizing efforts of pecan shelling women workers in San Antonio, Texas, and then of cannery workers in Los Angeles. In 1938, Luisa helped organize the Spanish-speaking People's Congress. During World War II, she fought against discrimination in hiring of Mexicans in oil and war-related industries. In the 1940s, she became centrally involved in high-profile legal defense cases of Mexican-American youth prosecuted on frame-up charges. These included work around the 1942 Sleepy Lagoon case and then of victims of the Zoot Suit riots a year later. She continued union work in California, helping to organize and represent walnut pickers. By 1950, she was caught in the crosshairs of the McCarthy-era witch hunts. Luisa was targeted by Operation Wetback and offered citizenship status in return for testimony against radical labor leader Harry Bridges. When she refused, she faced deportation on the accusation that she had once been a member of the Communist Party. She returned to Guatemala and continued organizing workers throughout Central America. Luisa Moreno died in Guatemala in 1992.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I said, one of my concerns is we're going to start seeing a January 6th type event every day as these school board meetings continue to happen. Because, look, this angry crowd, you're never going to appease them enough. Never. It's not going to happen. They're not going to be happy until everyone's kid has had it and everyone's sick, because that's their worldview. I actually have someone who believes, just like the mumps and the measles when we were kids, everybody got it and everybody lived. Well, not everybody, but most people. This isn't the same. Please stop with the dime store epidemiology. You didn't get your degree from the Cracker Jack box. They don't do that anymore. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, are we going to see a January 6th every day thanks to these knuckleheads? And should we be looking into the actual January 6th as a way maybe to stave off what I fear is coming? And here to share some thoughts on all of that, I've asked our good friend Jeff Hauser to come talk with us. Jeff is the executive director of the Revolving Door Project at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Jeff, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure.
So my premise is, my thought is, as I'm watching these videos from school board meetings across the country, is there's a well-organized, well-coordinated effort, well-funded effort to enrage these people and shoot them into school board meetings solely to take down, one, to take down our school boards, but also to create chaos and havoc.
Yeah, there are a few things going on. One is that January 6th as a topic of widespread, where there would be widespread disgust at the violence and behavior on January 6th, that has entirely receded from most coverage. Most people are not made to confront the enormity of the transgression of our democracy that occurred on that day, and the violence of it and the sheer terror that were experienced by people who were literally in the Capitol building of the United States government. So that's one thing that's happened. It's receded. The second is we have social media that are not run by specific editors, but there is an editorial philosophy, and that is embedded in what are called algorithms. And an algorithm is just a fancy way for about decisions. And so basically you set up, human beings set up algorithms. They tell the algorithm to favor some types of content based on some reason and to fuel people on it and like figure out what type of person might like something and give it to them. And what that does in the area of politics is tend to give people more extreme versions of what they heard before. And conspiratorial talk is really good at getting engagement, because once you start buying in to conspiracies, you're susceptible to accepting the next. So you have an entire population of people who exist in this ecosystem, which is disproportionately on the right. If you look at the most heavily engaged posts on Facebook every day, 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 10 come from crazy right-wing figures who would have had no traction in our media system 25 to 30 years ago. Those people consume that, and they are ready. They are like the latent shock troops of the right wing. And then you have the organized people, the cynics, the more people with institutional power who want to use that anger to further their anti-government, anti-equality, anti-fairness, pro-kleptocracy inclinations. And that includes attacking public schools. I mean, there's no institution that has been more consistently the target of right-wing derision than America's public schools. They hate the teachers' unions. They hate the idea. I mean, they believe in homeschooling. They believe in private schools. They certainly oppose integration. I mean, so much of the modern right-wing movement is still a reaction to Brown v. Board of Education and the desegregation of America's schools or the end of school prayer. Like, these are key cultural touchstones. And algorithms create ever angrier people. And the right-wing elites use those shock troops to threaten the legitimacy of institutions like public schools in this country. And it's extremely dangerous.
No, it is. And you look at the rhetoric that's come out. Just today, I was looking at a handful of videos, one from Encinitas, California, where the guy's calling for civil war. He's got the addresses of all of the school board members. We're coming to your house and we're going to get our guns in civil war. You look at the guy from Northampton County, Pennsylvania, just a couple hours from where I sit, who's talking about getting 20 guys to go into a school meeting, board meeting, and throwing them out and reinstalling people that, you know, they want, and then voting the other way. And I'm going, this is not how democracy works, but this is how fascist rule does work. And these are the people that they're going to use, and the ideas that they want to be able to move us forward, just like they wanted to do on January 6th.
Yeah, it's terrorism in the sense that it's politically oriented fear creation. I mean, people forget that the night before January 6th, the night of January 5th, there were bombs placed outside the Democratic National Committee building. I believe actually the RNC as well, because remember, they think there's an establishment Republican Party that is selling out the true Trump wing of the Republican Party. But that's still not even been solved, which is just a complete failure for the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI. But there is terror. We all remember that there were death threats and bombs mailed to Soros and a bunch of other figures before the 2018 midterm elections. There was a bombing of a synagogue before the 2018 election. Right-wing terror in this country is a key fact that alters how people behave. There are going to be school board members who are not going to do what they think is right because they just don't want to deal with the possibility that one person's rhetoric is going to be reality. And they'd be crazy to assume it's impossible. It's certainly possible. We've been seeing real violence in this country, and that's worrisome. And as you said, in terms of fascism, I mean, the more times people bend their will to, and terror succeeds, that only emboldens the terrorists. And right now, the lack of real repercussions for any of the senior figures who instigated January 6th has to be emboldening people on the right.
No, I've been saying all along, every one of the people who have been sentenced thus far has gotten a slap on the wrist, in my view. They should have been, the sentences should have been, you know, multiple times more than what they got, to send a message for the future people who want another January 6th, who want that to happen every time something they disagree with happens. And I've said for a long time, all of these little exercises are just tests. They're little tests to see how far they can push and how our system will react. And sadly, we're not reacting. We haven't gotten to the bottom of January 6th. And I don't see Merrick Garland from the outside looking in. It doesn't appear to me that he's moving as quickly as I think we should be moving. And our political class isn't moving quickly either. We should have been knee deep into this already.
Yeah, I think Garland is of the view that we can de-escalate things by papering over differences and hoping that the anger that was exhibited on January 6th will dissipate over time. And the reality is that due to those algorithms I was discussing before, the anger is only deepening. It is not going away. The people who are building out that anger, they are feeling emboldened by the lack of action on January 6th. And the situation is going to get worse. I think Garland and Wray, the FBI director that Donald Trump installed when he fired James Comey, we still have the same FBI director as Donald Trump installed. And for some reason, Joe Biden and Merrick Garland have decided that that is a wise course of action, which I disagree with. But between Garland and Wray, we have two senior figures who are trying to de-escalate passions surrounding January 6th. They're letting the court cases play out in as quiet a manner as possible. They're not having high profile, like, here's the state of the investigation, here's the big picture of our understanding about how this came to be, which you could talk about without biasing or prejudicing any of the individual specific legal cases. But it's the big picture dynamics about January 6th, which I think have been lost from the conversation. I think that reflects a decision by Wray and Garland. It isn't like some cynical strategic desire to then rebuild it up in an election year. It's to just dampen the passions. People were appalled in January and February of this year. And the reaction, basically 60, 70% of this country who are not stuck in those algorithmic hellholes are not paying attention to January 3rd. And it's the type of people who think, January 6th, and it's the people who think that those were martyrs. Those are the people who are thinking about it the most. And so what's going to happen is that the majority of society is going to forget, and the angry minority is going to get ever more aggrieved. And that imbalance does not lead to a good place.
No, you're absolutely right. And the rhetoric, and I don't know if you've noticed this as I have, the rhetoric is heating up. The threats are getting more frequent and more out, just completely, you know, we're going to start a civil war. We're going to go in and we're going to throw you out and we're going to install other, I mean, anti-democratic rhetoric from its core. And it's being met with a collective meh.
I mean, the stakes, if you listen to somebody like Tucker Carlson, are enormous. He both sometimes explicitly and often implicitly embraces replacement theory, which is the view that essentially Jews are bringing minorities into the country to reduce white control of the United States. And this is one of the animating principles of Charlottesville, of the right-wing zealots there. And if you think that American society, as you conceive of it, is under attack, that critical race theory is going to brainwash your kid, if your kid is white, into like hating white people or something. If you actually like take those crazy ideas seriously, and you think freedom is, that a mask mandate in a school is an act of fascism itself, if you think it's fascist, then it becomes an act of liberation and resistance to perpetrate violence. And like, yeah, I mean, it's inevitably we're going to see more violence, not less. And I think you just really have to scare people out of this sort of craziness. And you have to make the cynical people who are managing it on the high end really feel some negative consequences for their actions.
And that, again, comes back down to someone like Merrick Garland, who, to be honest, I'm sorry. And I know people who go, trust me, Rick, it's coming. They're going to go after Trump. They're going to hold Trump accountable. They're going to get all the people who are involved. It's going to take time. And I'm going, no, we don't have that kind of time. We don't have the wheels of justice grinding slowly kind of time, because the rhetoric keeps ramping up because no one sees that anyone's being held accountable. And look, it's my opinion, and you can disagree with me if you'd like, that we're never going to hold Trump accountable. We didn't hold Reagan accountable. We didn't hold H.W. Bush accountable. We didn't hold George W. Bush accountable for all his lies that got us into the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. What makes me think that we're going to hold Trump accountable? Especially with someone like Garland.
Yeah, I'm not optimistic right now. The Manhattan work seems to be moving at a very cautious way. And, you know, honestly, the Manhattan DA does not necessarily have the most slam dunk case out there. I think the Mueller investigation is kind of a bit of an original sin. They foreclosed the breadth of their own investigation, I think somewhat understandably, insofar as I think they were subject to being fired at like a moment's notice because Bill Clinton let the independent counsel law lapse. Mueller basically just served at the pleasure of the attorney general. That attorney general was Bill Barr. So I understand to some extent why he did not run a complete investigation and only track down some stuff. I think he thought, if I make the case of obstruction of justice clear enough, I don't need to go in after everything. This is such a slam dunk. It'll take care of itself. And obviously, Bill Barr managed to disappoint Robert Mueller, which shows you kind of what a naive fool. I mean, like a patriot and a commendable person on any number of different levels, Robert Mueller was. But ultimately speaking, at the biggest moment in his career, he was foolish and he got played by Bill Barr. And I think Merrick Garland is very much a figure like Bob Mueller. He's somebody who is a member of the establishment and has a difficult time picturing the modern Republican Party for what it is and how it does not reflect the genial people, you know, whose homes he visits on the cocktail party circuit.
Yeah, and they're definitely not good people on both sides. But now I'm seeing that the January 6th investigation is going after phone records and possibly some of the members of Congress. And I'm like, how can you not, especially now that we know Jim Jordan had not one, but two, maybe even more conversations with Donald Trump that day. We now know that there were others who, you know, Matt Gaetz supposedly had a conversation with Trump on that day. I think we have to know who was talking to the president, what was being said, and what was being coordinated.
Yeah, we have to. But there are two things we have to do. You have to find out as many facts are possible, and we have to find out those facts and convey them in a way that forces the media to engage with it seriously and not get distracted. And the way you need clash, you will need dramatic moments. It's not just a matter of assembling the facts. Like the free market of ideas does not, whether or not it ever worked like optimally, which I think, you know, I'm skeptical of, it is not working right now. One of the great skills that Mitch McConnell has, which is super simple in theory, even if maybe at times more difficult to execute, which is that if a topic is unpopular, it's not that he tells his people to vote the popular way. It's just don't engage with them. Change the topic. So whenever we're going to talk about Trump in January 6th, they'll try to talk about critical race theory or Afghan rebels coming up through the Mexico border to give us super COVID or something. Like, I mean, they're going to come up with crazy stuff. And it's our job to try to make the truth not only true, but as dramatic as possible, to find targets who will fight back so that there's clash, that there's dispute, and there's some interesting television and social media content to share. Yep. Like, we need this to not only be true, but we need it to be vivid so that people can remember how scary January 6th really was.
Which is why I was against Nancy Pelosi not allowing Jim Jordan on the Republican side. I wanted Jordan on that dais so that Liz Cheney could point to him and go, "You were there. Why did you do this?" And he's already there. I don't ever see him being subpoenaed and sitting in the chair. For me, that was a way to get him there and do just what you said.
Yeah, I don't think the current generation of Democratic leaders is uncomfortable with the messy types of politics which are needed. In an era where there were three network news channels and what they decided people should know was the main basis of common information in this country, a certain gentility worked as a political strategy. But now we are fighting desperately for attention, and Democrats are not comfortable forcing attention on the issues that they want to elevate.
I'm right there with you. Jeff, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. Always good talking with you. Thanks so much, brother.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Jeff Hauser, Executive Director of the Revolving Door Project at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Make sure you check out their website, revolvingdoorproject.org. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Revenue Tax Act, more popularly known as the wealth tax. The act reformed the federal income tax to raise rates on the wealthiest in the nation. Those making over $5 million a year could pay taxes up to 75%. In a speech to Congress that summer, Roosevelt had explained his thoughts on wealth and taxes. The president said, quote, "Wealth in the modern world does not come merely from individual effort. It results from a combination of individual effort and of the manifold uses to which the community puts that effort. The individual does not create the product of his industry with his own hands. He utilizes the many processes and forces of mass production to meet the demands of a national and international market. Therefore, in spite of the great importance in our national life of the efforts and ingenuity of unusual individuals, the people in the mass have inevitably helped to make large fortunes possible. Without mass cooperation, FDR said, great accumulation of wealth would be impossible save by unhealthy speculation." The president went on, as an Andrew Carnegie put it, where wealth accumulates honorably, the people are always silent partners. Whether it be wealth achieved through the cooperation of the entire community or riches gained by speculation, in either case, the ownership of such wealth or riches represents a great public interest and a great ability to pay. Although FDR tried to win over the nation's wealthy by quoting industrialist Andrew Carnegie, he did not gain their support. Not surprisingly, many of the nation's wealthy lobbied for and used tax loopholes to evade paying the new tax rates. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So all the rhetoric surrounding what's going on in Afghanistan, all the blame on Biden, it's all Biden's fault. All the division over the death of our soldiers. And it's all by design, as I've said for the longest time. This is a way to keep the working class of this country pitted against one another, to keep that constant rage, that constant chaos in place. But the question comes down to, is this solely the work of the wealth class dividing us so that we don't realize how badly we've been getting screwed for the last 40 years? Is this them and their mayhem makers? Is this the Russians? Is it the North Koreans, the Iranians? Or is it the Chinese? Or is it all of them? And here to share some thoughts on, you know, how is this going to affect how we deal with the international community, especially the Chinese? Because I see them as, well, I'm seeing them kind of finding their way into the middle of this. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what this might look like, I've asked our good friend Emily Delabure to come talk with us. She's the co-founder of Horizon Advisory, horizonadvisory.org, their website. She's my go-to expert on all China. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
So am I overly concerned about the Chinese finding their way into Afghanistan and, well, Afghanistan's rich in minerals, they're rich in a bunch of things. Am I concerned about that?
It's a tough one, and one that goes in every direction. Wherever China's concerned or is involved, let's say, not wrong to be concerned, would be a first hot take. And on the Afghanistan question in particular, I mean, I think Beijing is rightfully a little ambivalent. On the one hand, it's absolutely been in China's interest to see the U.S. diverting its attention towards the Middle East, diverting resources there, strained, and also seeing its global profile decrease as a result of our presence. And also, it's absolutely in China's interest to see the U.S. now on the retreat and being viewed as a failed power, absolutely, in this engagement. However, China doesn't want instability in the Middle East. That's really bad for them. They worry about what it means for global resources, what it means for terrorism, including terrorism on their border, and just for general instability that can directly affect their domestic affairs. And they don't want to be sucked into what they see as endless conflict and unresolvable conflict in that region. Like, they don't want to have to be the players with a military presence in the Middle East. And the U.S. has been doing that for China, for the world, for years now. That said, we know that Beijing is adept at taking advantage of any opening that we leave China. And this is bound to be no exception. There's already been the outreach between Beijing and the Taliban. They know where to find resources that matter. And this is an empowered China over the past year that's not going to shirk from any opportunity.
Right. And I look at the stunt that they tried to pull in Vietnam ahead of Vice President Kamala Harris's visit, where I guess she was delayed for a couple of minutes, and they tried to swoop in and say, no, instead of the 1 million or the 1 billion doses of whatever the vaccine, we're going to give you two. And again, it's what they do. It does show how emboldened they think they are.
And really, up until about a year ago, this was a China that played, you know, kind of a game in the wake of the U.S. and was absolutely competing with America, but was doing so like by being the spoiler on the corner or right behind. And now Beijing is like absolutely willing to do that, to get in front of the story, and to be on the center stage going blow for blow. And you know, that was true in Vietnam with the vaccines. It's going to be true across the board. And it's what, you know, is true of rhetoric coming out of China. They have this new buzzword phrase of dual circulation that everyone's talking about and no one quite understands, but it really, what it effectively means is that China now sees itself as the driving force for how things are moving internationally.
And I would argue a lot of that has to do with our misadventures in the Middle East, our divisions at home especially, because look, I don't view the Taliban as a dangerous force to me in any way, shape, or form right now. And I don't view them as dangerous as perhaps some of the people that live in my neighborhood and some of the insanity that we've been seeing with our domestic terrorists who are now terrorizing our school board meetings.
There's a story that we're not like necessarily talking about right now, which is that, so domestically we have this insane division and fragmentation and everything moving in opposite directions. And at the same time in China, we're seeing an absolute crackdown intended to put everybody on the same page and in line with the Chinese Communist Party. And both of these stories are being covered individually, but they're not being put together in terms of the asymmetry this creates and what it means that we're getting one player crack down on its authoritarian control over the entire society while the other player fails for even 1 second to be on the same page.
And again, you know, we've talked about this before, where our freedoms have really been our biggest downfall, especially when dealing with China, because they come in, they buy things up. They basically leave us with empty shells of factories and you know, manufacturing capacity and beyond. I mean, like you said, they're walking in the same direction while we're ripping each other apart. It is one and the same story, I think.
Which is going to be, I mean, just to absolutely switch onto a whole other news headline or story right now, that's going to be the big question of the infrastructure bill. If we're putting that money into American infrastructure, like that's the kind of thing that can restore some degree of U.S. cohesion, at the very least, like U.S. manufacturing. But historically, that's also been the kind of thing where China comes in and does all the infrastructure building and uses American spending as an opportunity to be an even stronger presence in the U.S. And you know, further virtualize our economy and further tear us apart. So that's going to be, like, I think a really, we've gotten to this point with the idea that there's a commitment to spend money, kind of. And the real question is going to be, how is that money spent? And is it something that defends against what China is doing or feeds into it?
No, and that's the one thing that I think does unite us as a country. And I, no matter who I talk to, if it's a flag waving Trump supporter, it's you know, Buy American provisions in our procurement policies. It's making sure that the steel we're using is made here in the U.S. The welders that are doing the job are from here in the U.S. I think that's one of those things that could potentially, if this was done right, actually bring us, you know, back to somewhere near, maybe not together, but at least somewhere in the same arena.
Yeah. And on board with what's taking place, like with what our leadership is doing, because then you can have some amount of faith that there's actually an effort to restore the U.S. real economy and jobs in America and to provide services to Americans, because that's what infrastructure does. So like this is like the big opportunity, but then what happens if China does what it did in 08, 09 and at every other juncture it's had and make sure that it's Chinese companies that are providing this deal?
No, and I don't blame them. Look, I don't blame them at all.
It's brilliant.
It's brilliant. Yeah. They're simply figuring out how to use our rules against us. And we allow it to happen. You know, I've been saying our trade deals are bad, are horrible, abysmal. But I don't blame them for doing it to us. I blame us for allowing it to happen. If you steal my lunch out of my hand, it's my fault for letting you do it.
Oh, yeah. Like, I wish we were playing as smart as they are. It's mind-blowing. And like, they are better at our legal system than we are, which is insane. And they're better at recruiting like the best U.S. lawyers to be good at our legal system than we are. And that's not a great position to be in.
No, but then again, it comes back down to the money and the hidden money and all of the resources that go into keeping us divided. And that's why I keep asking, who is it that's funding these groups, because it's eerily familiar as you go from state to state to state, where all of these people are all on the same page. They're all barking the same orders. They're all making the same threats. There's coordination here, and there's a funding mechanism that is moving them in this direction.
Yeah, and you know, I don't want to be the one, you know, to be spouting major conspiracies, but like, it's true that all of that does benefit China. And even if they're not the direct player, they're absolutely going to be ready to amplify any message that's in their interest and to make sure it reaches the people that it's in their interest for them to reach. And there's also like no question that Chinese policy and discourse are very clear about how important and easy it is to influence the subnational level in the US. Like, they have a whole line of efforts that's about developing state and local level influence over governments, over private sector industry players, over like cultural and educational institutions. And the idea is, like, if not necessarily to be the player that's spreading the narrative, then to create a fertile landscape for that narrative so that everybody is ready to believe or to think whatever's in China's interest.
So how come that's not across every headline and every person in this country isn't on the top of the brain? Because I'll tell you, you know, when I look at their manufacturing prowess and I look at the number of jobs that we have in manufacturing at this moment, and maybe it's just because I'm a manufacturing geek, I'm like, you know, we have fewer jobs than we had when my grandparents were alive and working. And we were, a fifth of the population? There's something wrong, Houston, and it comes back down to what we build. It comes back to our supply chains. It comes back to the policies that we've allowed to get rammed through so that a handful of people could get really rich and a generation of workers could get screwed.
Yeah, and we're at the point where, so like base level economics, that's really bad for the country, but we're also at the point where this is like fundamental national security. Like, we can't make what we need to like maintain our military. And that's, we should be at a point where everybody can agree that this is a really, like a very real problem, not just the people who recognize the value of manufacturing for an economy and for a society to be maintained. Because at least there's supposed to be a consensus that we need a military and we need to self-protect. And we're so far in the red. And I'm not sure anybody is out there with the headlines agreeing.
No, it's crazy where we are. So the question is, you know, is there a way to undo the direction we're heading? Because as you've said, you know, China views itself as the superpower of the next generation. And, you know, we and the rest of the globe, I don't know what the answer is going forward.
Yeah. And so China's big playbook is not only, you know, beat us at our game and not only, you know, subsidize and use non-market measures to take over strategic industries and manufacturing. It's also to target the new domains, you know, that technology is creating in particular as quote unquote leapfrog opportunities, and especially to build the infrastructures of those new domains. So there's a category called new infrastructures. It's been a huge deal in Chinese industrial policy for the past 3 years. And that's where the real push is. And we talk here about, oh, there's a science and technology race. We have to beat them at AI. We have to beat them at big data. Beijing echoes, like, believes that, but their focus isn't on the research and development. It's on building the real economy and the infrastructures that are necessary to support those technologies. So electric vehicle charging stations, data centers, the industrial Internet of Things, high-speed rail, everything that's like physical and without which we can't apply these technologies, but also that you can use to project them and their power internationally. And you know, it's a brilliant strategy. Again, like, they're doing this right. But I also like to think that as we lose ground, that also is an opportunity for us. It is a new battle that's like taking place in terms of manufacturing and in terms of the industrial competition, because technology is making it such. And China's been going about it in a smarter way, but we're still just at the starting line because these technologies really still are just taking shape. So if we can take our infrastructure efforts and our like newfound consensus on the need for this and on manufacturing and point it in the smart direction, which is towards like actually applying new technologies and building the infrastructures that are going to allow like not just the research and development, but the infrastructures that are going to allow our society to take advantage of that and to have relatively similar access to it, That resolves so much. That takes care of manufacturing. It makes us more competitive in new domains. And it also provides the basic access to services like networks and connectivity that can let our society like actually have some degree of opportunity access pervasively, and that we don't have in a world where there's like no wireless in much of the country.
So last line of questioning I want to get into, because, you know, we want to get to where you're talking about going. The right will tell you the way we get there is we cut taxes, we cut regulation, and we let the free market decide. Those on the left are going to go, no, we need targeted investment. We need smart policy. We need a big, chunky infrastructure bill, like the $3.5 trillion bill, like the $1.2 trillion. We need that. And even I would argue we need more. We need something even bigger than the $1.2 trillion hard infrastructure bill. Is either side right? Is there a blend? How do you see a way to get where we need to go?
In any area that's strategic, if we absolutely just let the free market, we're going to get China, because they're going to bend the free market to their will, or not their will, but to their interests. And I think, you know, that just, it means we need industrial policy. We can't, because we're not China, have the same kind of state-led model that they do, because that's just not how we work. But yeah, we need targeted industrial policy that includes Made in America provisions and that supports US manufacturing in vertically integrated supply chains, or at least loosely vertically integrated supply chains. So we're not just making the end product, we're also making the multiple steps along it. That's going towards the targeted areas that matter. And ideally it's not clunky and it's not, you know, the government trying to figure out how things work, but it is smart and focused on the right areas.
As I say, I'm not against the idea of public-private partnerships. I'm not against the use of public money to do private ventures, just as long as the public benefits from it. If we need roads or bridges, I'm not against the idea of hiring a private company to do it with certain parameters in place. But ultimately, it's got to benefit we the people. We don't use public money to put up a toll road for private interests to cash in on. It just seems counterintuitive. So for me, it's got to be smart investment. We're going to see where this goes. And sadly, I don't have a lot of hope for where we are in this country in this moment, especially as we are this divided. But Emily, I appreciate you taking some time and sharing your expertise. As always, great stuff.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. Our good friend Emily Delabrouille. Make sure you check out their website, horizonadvisory.org. Good stuff there. We'll take a quick break right here. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1921. That was the day that one of the most pitched battles in U.S. labor history, the Battle of Blair Mountain, began in West Virginia. Coal fueled the engines of industry, keeping the trains moving and the steel mills humming. Labor organizing in the coal fields faced violent repression. The conflict turned bloody at Mattawan. Friend of labor, local lawman Sid Hatfield, had won a gun battle against armed members of the notorious Baldwin Felts Detective Agency. Then, other Baldwin Felts agents, brought to West Virginia by the mine owners, gunned down Hatfield in cold blood. The miners' anger boiled over. 600 miners gathered under the United Mine Workers of America District 17 banner. The armed miners were determined to march into the state's southern coal fields. Their aim was to promote the union effort and sweep away the gunmen hired by the mining companies. As they marched, more and more miners joined them. As many as 10,000 miners converged on Blair Mountain. The high ground stood between the unionized northern part of the state and the less organized southern mines. At Blair Mountain, they met Logan County Sheriff Don Chafin, who had amassed an army of 3,000 armed men to repel the miners. Chafin's men had dug trenches, blocked roads, and marshaled machine guns to stop the Union men. In the battle that ensued, 1 million rounds were fired. The mine owners hired private planes to drop shrapnel bombs on the miners. The United States Army finally arrived. The miners, many of them World War I veterans, surrendered. Although the owners had won, what occurred at Blair Mountain drew national attention to the unsafe working conditions and the brutality of the coal barons in the coal fields.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.